Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm rebroadcasting an interview I did with concert pianist Eleonora Lvov to let you know about the two concerts that she has coming up in January. January 3rd at the Manatee Unitarian Universalist Fellowship in Bradenton. At 4 o'clock in the afternoon, she's doing a performance called New Year's Romance on the Piano. And you can get information about that and tickets by calling 941-358-0235. And then on Sunday, January 17th, also at 4 o'clock, she's doing a performance called Grand Piano, Chopin and Friends at the Unitarian Universalist Church of Sarasota, where you can get tickets at 941-358-0235. In this interview, Eleonora talks about her early life, her connection to music, and what she believes she is bringing to music in the most outrageous and extraordinary way. So hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from the voice. Oh, you really can. Deeper, deeper down survive, finding wisdoms otherwise. Oh, you really can. And it's always there, like a silent hug from nowhere, sitting in my own soft lap, with all the time for us to chat, and my resources all on tap. Oh,
is about being the person you really are. And in my show, I interview people who make their living or their life within art. And I do this because when you listen to someone who makes their living or their life within art, you are listening to someone who, at least in the area of that work, is being exactly who they really are. You can hear it. It's glaring. It's apparent. And because, as a therapist, I know that so many of us are only living versions of who we are, not the complete, whole, essential self that we are. It is my hope that when you listen to these people, you will hear what it sounds like and ask yourself, is this how I feel about my life? And perhaps, if it is not, think about how you might recapture what you might have lost. In today's show, I am airing an interview with Eleonora Lvov. Eleonora is a concert pianist, and she is very definitely exactly who she is. Music has been the driving force in her life. So this is a long interview which I did not want to cut, so without further ado, I'm going to play my interview with Eleonora, and it is going to be followed by a cut from one of her many CDs, Eleonora playing Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue.
All right, so I am here with Eleonora Lvov in her lovely home, and I'm explaining to Eleonora that I interview people who make their living or their life with an art, and you clearly make your living and your life with the art of playing piano.
Hmm? Right, it's not only what I do, it's actually, I feel, what I am.
Yes. So I only ask one question, and that is, do you remember the very first moment in your life when music or playing... Yes, you're saying yes. So
oh, yes, I am nodding the head.
Okay, tell me.
Well, first of all, I must say, I grew up in Russia, mm-hmm. and I was... literally growing up under the piano, because at that time it was still Soviet Union and we had one room in which my parents and my grandmother and I, a newborn, was living. Mm-hmm. And so there was a big grand piano. So for me, a little baby, the crib was right under the piano, literally. Then when I grew up a little, I would sit under the piano while my father and mother, who are both pianists, practiced and played, and sometimes students would come in and play, and I would be under the piano. So, of course, the psychiatrist would have a grand old field trip with me, because I love this big, luscious sound.
Yes, that was coming all over you.
Which was right. I was in it.
Yes.
It wasn't coming at you.
No. It was literally surrounding you.
Oh,
right?
It is unbelievable. In fact, I have a few friends, not one, but few, who love coming and lying under my piano now as I play, because I seduce them to try it.
Yeah, it's lovely.
It's unbelievable. The sound is totally different. So when I make my CDs and I'm checking, I always check against that sound. And people say, well, that's unrealistic. Nobody hears it like that in the concert hall. I don't care.
Right.
That's what I want.
Yes.
I am hooked.
Yes.
So that's one thing. So I don't know whether that was the time when I really became totally engrossed in music. But later, more consciously so, I was in my early teens.
Well, let me ask you a question before that. So your mother and father, both pianists.
Yes.
Both practicing, mm-hmm. right?
And my mother is my first teacher.
And my father
is my next teacher, or rather, to put it more precisely, when I would feel in my teens that I can actually play 27 times for my mother, then I would dare to play for my father, who actually taught in Moscow Conservatory.
Wait, you got ahead of me. When did you start to take lessons? How old were you? Before you remember.
Right. Yes. So, because I was under the piano, remember?
Yeah, no.
And then I migrated towards the keyboard.
Well, that's the question. And maybe this is so much of a piece that you don't have a separate memory of it. But did they put you on the piano stool?
Well, I would have to be actually put on the piano mm-hmm. stool. Same happened with my daughter, by the way. As soon as she would be crawling and would be able to pull herself up to the keyboard, you see, that I do remember. Mm-hmm. I was actually an adult at that moment.
Right.
And she was trying to put her little fingers, and she could hardly press the key.
Right.
So I figured, well, I might as well teach her how to do it correctly.
Okay, so do you think that's what your parents did?
Probably. Okay. Most likely.
So you were at the piano, playing at it, learning it from two, from five,
maybe
from
four,
six, right?
No, earlier than that.
Yes?
Oh, yes, definitely. Earlier, perhaps four.
Okay.
But that's not a usual thing, because actually, usually people often ask me, by the way, and you can that out, is when do you want to start teaching children? And the consensus is actually six or seven.
Mm-hmm.
But in my case, or in some extra... ordinary cases, actually when children go to the piano,
yes.
it's good to maybe not give them formal lessons when they are three, because that's futile,
mm-hmm.
but at least color correct what they're doing, mm-hmm. so they don't bang.
Right.
You know, or they, if they already put the hands on the keyboard, that they would do it properly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And the posture. And, you know, you just do 5 minutes here and 5 minutes there.
Yeah.
And that's what I did with my daughter, actually.
Okay. So when do you think you started official lessons with your mom?
Probably 4 and a half, mm-hmm. 5 o'clock. Five,
do you remember any of that?
Yes, some of it, yes, I do.
Do you remember?
And, I remember that immediately, as soon as I would start being taught, I was being taught the notation and also memorization. So when people ask me, how do you remember all this myriads and myriads of notes? I actually tongue-in-cheek say, one note at a time. They think I am tongue-in-cheeking.
Right.
But actually it's true, because my mom taught me how to memorize, and it's like you teach anybody how to memorize, let's say, a piece of text, you know, and it's one thing at a time, repeat, 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 so it rolls off your tongue. Mm-hmm. Well, in my case, it rolls
off your fingers.
Off my fingers, correct.
Yeah.
And you do it very, very carefully, very mm-hmm. detailed. But that's about the memory. It's a very interesting subject, actually, within itself. In fact, I am in the process of writing a book with my with a friend of mine who also is my student, because he felt that it's got to be out there, because people are always asking how to memorize things.
Ah.
You know, and you don't just play it over and over and over again, and somehow, miraculously, you memorize
that, right?
No, there is a system to how to do that. There are mnemonic devices, this and that. So it's a very complex process, very painstaking, but very rewarding.
Yes, and if you start at four,
and,
you know, it's not that tough.
And
I seduce,
yes, literally,
right.
Most of my students, and I love teaching adults. So especially when an adult comes in, he might have or she might have played throughout their lives,
right,
and never knew how to do it. Or in childhood they had very good memory and they just could indeed play it over,
yes,
and over,
right,
and somehow remember it. But now all of a sudden in their middle age they said, oh, my memory is not so good no more. Excuse me, my double negative. but so I said, oh, no worry. I will teach you how to, and amazingly, you can do it at any age. My oldest student's at 94.
Wow.
And I really did seduce him to do it.
Well, that's wonderful, and I'm sure the book will be extremely useful. So, let me go back.
Mm-hmm.
So here you are at 4, at 5, at 6, at 7, you're sitting at the piano and your mom is teaching you to hold correctly, to play, you
very
know,
important,
right,
yes,
and she's beginning to teach you about notation, about memorization.
Right away.
Right.
Immediately.
Right. And do you remember, did you love it? I mean, did you?
Yes. I actually loved, it's interesting, it's a very good question, because what do you love? Sometimes people ask me, I am jumping ahead, do you enjoy playing concerts? And I say, I don't know whether that's a right word, because what you love is the result of sometimes very hard, very painstaking work. And I was brought up in the most rigorous Russian school, you know, so, you know, all the way through into the Moscow Conservatory. And you really work at it. I mean, 9-10 hours a day.
Wow.
Once I am in the high teens,
mm-hmm.
once I'm, and I was in a special school where actually they allowed us, they would have 5 hours, let's say, of lessons, a school,
mm-hmm.
high school.
Okay.
And the rest of it was do piano, do violin, whatever you are doing, hours and hours and hours. They gave us that gift
mm-hmm.
of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was a special school for the musically gifted children in Moscow. And they have, by the way, those special schools for all disciplines, gymnastics and sports and ballet, and there is a school for everything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And they do creme de la creme. They take all the kids from all Soviet Union, and there are 25 children, no more, in one single class level.
Wow.
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
So 25 kids from all over Soviet Union.
Okay, so at I was really interested to hear you say the thing about, you know, if you could play it for your mother for 27 times, then you could play it for your father.
Uh-huh.
So did you sort of graduate to him?
It's sort of like the other way around. I wouldn't dare to play for my mother, for my father, before
right.
I would play 27 times for my mother.
Yes.
And 27 is just a nice number.
I understand.
You know, it's a good
number. So your mother was teaching you, and you were progressing, and at some point...
At some point, because then we moved from one room to three rooms, apartment, which was totally luxurious, and they had two grand piano now. So the nice little vignette is the fact that there would be always two pianos going. I don't envy my neighbors. But we also had one of us always in the middle room, in between the two pianos, in the cacophony of sound.
Right.
So, because the walls weren't insulated terribly well. You know, the music was just a part of it, and by that time I was like 11 or 12, and my dad once walked into the kitchen, which was the congregational room, you know, where you congregate, and he said, "Did I hear you play some Beethoven the other day? Because that was darn good, you know?" So that was the beginning of the end. In other words, that's when he started to put his hand in, because my father was really one of the top four pianists in Russia. Traditionally, we had, like, and he had friends like Gilels and Richter. That was his generation. His friends, if you are familiar with those names, those are greatest pianists of 20th century in Russia, so in Soviet Union at the time. So he was always teaching in a conservatory. He was not teaching kids.
Yes, right, not even his
so
own.
So that's why when he came in and I crouched, or I put my head down, because I revered him. I loved going to his concerts. And to answer your earlier questions, because we are going out on the tangents all the time, is that whenever I would go to his concerts, or to great other pianists, but he had this unbelievable genius among people, and I think that's what I really wanted, and it will probably come up in the next 10 minutes again, is that he was able to take the music from the realm of up high somewhere, put it through his body into this wooden box of a piano, and out comes not just sounds, but emotions and images. And I have goosebumps right now on me as I remember how the walls would disappear. I would be sitting there, you know, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 14, and I would just be transported. And so now when somebody comes backstage and says, you know, we just went out somewhere, the ceiling was blown off and there was just the sky, you know, with the infinity of the universe, or maybe multiverses, you know, we were just out there somewhere. I feel that's like the best compliment. I mean, I don't mind when people come and say, oh, that was beautiful, you know, but when somebody teary-eyed would say, wow, I just went out somewhere, like light came in and just apocalyptic, you know, sometimes it becomes ecclesiastic kind of, you know, well, that was a salvation, just the radiant realm to say, oh, thank you, because many last movements of finale, you know, of my new concerto, for example, Beethoven concerto, my new recording, I meant to say, and it's a concerto, the second last movement, the finale, is indeed apocalyptic. So if somebody doesn't tell me that it takes them into this radiant realms of light, with the capital L, well, I didn't do my job.
You know, this brings up an interesting point, which has never occurred to me before, but I think that it takes... this is one of the things that art is supposed to do. It's supposed to transport you, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems to me that the artist is responsible for creating a work that is capable of transporting.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
But not everyone is capable of being transported.
True, too.
Do you understand what I'm saying?
Absolutely do understand you.
So not everybody could go there because they couldn't go there. Not because the art didn't
most of the times I believe I take your point totally. What I am thinking as you speak is that if we are talking about the greatest artists of history, whether be that performing art or even literature, philosophy, religious works, or let's call it spiritual works, so we don't go to deep to, you know, threatening realm of religion, and visual arts, all that, the greatest artists, I believe, basically transport most anybody. However, what I've discovered in my lifetime, which is very, very interesting discovery, I mean, you bring lovely points, is that the most, the people who have most inside them to be transported, they will perceive, let's say, my music. They can tell me, and the other day just I got a message from somebody who was at my concert, oh, I saw colors, iridescency, luminosities, you know, all this radiance, I don't know, I just felt, and then she progressed into telling me precisely what story she had in mind while I was playing.
Wow.
And I had those people, you know, and I love those couple of friends in my lifetime who actually could sit and do something while I'm practicing and all of a sudden just pick their heads up. And, you know, I was blessed with my husband like that. And, you know, they would pick up the head and say, you know, I just saw ta-ta-ta. And they would go into this description.
Right.
Because you have to also be literary enough to be able to actually tell me what they saw. And I love talking about music. I always do that a bit in my concerts. You know, I would talk about the piece. Not too concretely, but more like giving people a little bit of imagery. And that's for those who are maybe not predisposed to necessarily go there,
yes,
or be
right.
transported. And what I find is that those people will still feel it. There would be a feeling. Maybe they won't be able to verbalize it or to even admit that they went out somewhere. You know, it's like meditation.
Yes.
You know, if you are used to TM, transcendental, then you will be transcended. You will be transported. But those who aren't may still feel something, maybe not as concrete, and they will just not be able to quite express it back at me.
Mm-hmm.
But I did find, Lynn, it's a very long answer to a very short question, but I love that question, because it brings me right to where I feel the source of music is, which is the source, for the lack of better word, you know, with the capital S, or spirit with the capital S. And again, I don't go religious terribly much, but I do feel absolutely, totally, that the source is outside of me.
It's coming through.
Absolutely. That's the word you just said. Because people say sometimes, oh, it just feels like it comes from the very depths of you. And I say, well, no, it goes through the depths of me.
Yeah.
And the depths that I'm not even able to access sometimes by myself. It just as a cathartic sometimes experience. And my best concerts, best meaning, quote unquote, is when the best success, you know, I feel totally uplifted. I feel uplifted.
Yeah.
In fact, that's why I'm so excited about my newest CD, because that concert was with orchestra, with Cleveland. And this is one of the best orchestras, you know. And so when I felt that I keep again telling you about this last movement, when I felt I was ready to just fly off that stage. In fact, you had to be very careful, because I can fly off the stage. And then I'm not sure that my hands will keep doing what I'm not supposed to be doing. So I have to have this upper layer of supervisor in me totally, mm-hmm. that I would not let myself to totally get into this, incredible climactic moment. But it just absolutely filled with that light, with capital L, that I'm talking about. And people say, oh my gosh, you know, we had this incredible transcendental, mm-hmm. you know, they may not use that word, but experience, peak experience. And that's what I feel. So if I don't get there, mm-hmm. oh yeah, so that's when I feel that the spirit just flashes through me.
Okay,
so, and it's incredibly intense.
Okay.
It's intensity par excellence.
So I'm going to keep backing you up here.
Oh, yeah.
So so at some point, your father heard you and thought, oh, now she is someone that I would be willing to work with.
Right. And actually should be.
Right. Working
getting
with.
My hand in there.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And so then you began to work with only him or with both your mother?
No, I was
always
working with my mother and father forever.
Uh-huh.
And as I said before, mm-hmm. I wouldn't just dare to play. See, I needed the security that I can play and he can tell me, okay, play that left hand in that bar. See, he wouldn't mess with me. I mean, I could not mess around with him, rather. I would be needing to know that piece backwards and forwards, almost literally, that if he asks me to play three notes of my left hand in a bar 375,
yes.
I had to be able to do that, or else all hell would break loose.
Okay, so let me see if I get this. You're learning essentially from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
Your father is tweaking.
Yes.
Not actually the word
yes.
I want, but right?
Mm-hmm.
He's helping to make it
kind of
stronger,
color
better,
correct.
Right?
Before
you're
my
right.
performance, he
right.
would just come in and inspire me to even higher heights. My mother is a fantastic teacher, and she would always teach me to be expressive. You see, all my expressivity
mm-hmm.
that people so say, you know, that's a uniqueness, of my performing versus, let's say, many, many great pianists who can just sit down and play a storm.
Right.
And I can play a storm all right, but what then makes me unique? Because I sometimes, you know, and for forever and ever, you know, we are brought up to be very modest, and it sounded terribly arrogant for me to say, oh, I am this or I am that. So I figured out finally that it's not arrogance, it's just a unique niche
mm-hmm.
that people, and my father was that, and he instilled that in me, or rather, he evoked what I had.
Right.
You know, and taught me how to use it. But that was what he did unbelievably. He had that genius as a teacher as well as a pianist, which is, by the way, very different
yes.
two skills.
No kidding.
And I actually inherited that too because I love teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I love teaching on any level, by the way. I don't just teach advanced people. I teach anybody
mm-hmm.
as long as they want to be taught. You know, but what I was going to say is that unique expressivity that will be able to transport people
yes.
is really what he was doing with me. And my mother would make me able to do that. And then my father would take over and just totally, it just would become like a volcano erupting.
Yeah.
Versus just volcano,
which is
impressive enough, you know.
Yeah. And it sounds like your mother was giving you the nuts and bolts. And
how to do it, because mm-hmm. it's not just, oh yeah, express this, oh yeah, express that. You have to know how to. It's a physical process.
Ah.
Physical process of how to put your arms and body into that keyboard.
Wow.
And make it happen. And sometimes it's tender, and I always tell to my students, whatever your hands feel, not only what your soul feels, but whatever your hands feel, that's how the sound is going to come through the piano.
Mm.
If you feel tender, or rather if you want it
mm-hmm.
to be tender, then you have to feel you are caressing
Yes.
The keys, and sometimes even people say, oh, it feels like you're making love, excuse me, to your piano. And I said, yes, absolutely, sometimes tender, sometimes passionate, and everything in between. And that is the skill. That's a skill.
Mm-hmm.
And so many, many people sometimes play this feeling, but somehow they express their feelings more in their bodies. In fact, one friend the other day said, oh, I saw this this lady who played. She was so expressive in the body, but it wasn't quite coming through into the sound. And I said, well, that's a skill.
Yeah.
Right. And she may be a great pianist. I mean, pianist.
Yes.
She may, as I said, play a storm. And yet it will not actually come through as an experience.
There's something else this is something else that you were talking about that I wanted to go back to. The idea of the music coming through you. Did your parents talk about that, or
no.
Is that something you came to by yourself?
That is something that I came to feel. It was given to me. You know, if I really were ecclesiastic, I would say God found me.
Yes.
In that case, it's truly, well, in truth, from I lived in Russia, and then we left Russia.
Yeah, I want to hear that story.
Yeah,
actually.
We left Russia, and we lived after that in all sorts of places, including Israel, by the way. And I was in Jerusalem for several years, and that was an unbelievable experience. It was not even quote-unquote religious in its nature. It was more just starting to feel that there is something beyond what we can feel and touch, because I mean, feel with our five senses.
I understood.
And the Soviet Union, where I was, is still Soviet Union, was totally atheistic. So at that time, music was a god. For me, music and love. Music and love, I thought, was two gods. You know, actually, it's one god with two faces. That's how I felt. And that's, by the way, when I felt that, that's when I started to feel I want to be able to do actually what my father does, to transport people. In fact, I even said, if I only could do it once in my life, I could die after that and be happy. Well, of course,
it wasn't enough.
I am scratching my head right now and said, I've done it so many times, and yet I dare to get down on myself or down on God that I'm not quite happy with this or not quite happy with that. Well, I already have done that, and people did come with tears in their eyes, literally streaming down their cheeks. So I said, I can die happy. Now I can do it. Well, no, I'm not ready to die.
No.
I want to do it another few times.
Right.
You know, I love people to come actually to my house and listen to me practice sometimes. And when I see that I am doing something to them, or rather not I, but music does, then I said, oh, that's good. That's why I like to practice with somebody here, because actually then I know it's doing something. And some other times it's not doing anything. So, well, I didn't do my job, so let me do it better.
Well, again, I think that it isn't always that. I think, you know, well, you may disagree, but I really think that the receiver...
Yes. It has to be tuned in.
Yeah, right.
Yes,
true. Yes, exactly.
Yes,
you
of
know?
Course, of course. But even so, I am color correcting that statement because I thought so too. But I'm finding out that people who actually were not even candidates in my mind to be transported. Again, I know that it has happened many a time already that I thought, but they went somewhere. And they could not acknowledge it.
Yes.
In fact, sometimes almost despite themselves. That's why I'm color correcting your experience. But it's a very interesting discussion, actually. It's a philosophical, spiritual.
Right.
Yeah.
So, under what circumstances did you guys leave the Soviet Union?
Well, we actually didn't escape, quote-unquote, thank God. We actually left legally, but it was very difficult process.
How old were you?
I was around 16, so it was actually a very difficult time. because we weren't sure whether we are going to go west, where we wanted to go, or east, to Siberia. Because that's what happened with the enemies of the people.
Yes.
And my father was officially proclaimed because he wanted to leave, and he was very much up there in the
eyes. He was well known.
Yes. So, you know, it wasn't a good thing for the Soviet government to let him go.
Right.
To let him go, or to even the fact that he wanted to leave. Like, yeah. What? You don't have enough here?
Right.
All the glory and, you know, good stuff and
but
money,
he did want
money.
To go.
Yes, yes. For that reason, that we weren't free, that the spiritual life wasn't there. And again, that comes back to that idea of whether music comes through me. At that time, you know, artists in Soviet Union in general, and especially those few like my father, who are basically spiritual people in the core of them. Whether they believe in God or not, it's irrelevant. Spirituality is a state of soul, you know, and my father was. So he felt that he wanted freedom of expression. And they hated Soviet Union, Soviet regime. You know, there are great things about Russia. Mm-hmm. I love Russia. I love going there. Actually, in playing there. People are great. I get best reception in Russia as a performer. That goes to actually confirm your point, which is receptivity.
Yeah. Okay.
So Russia, extremely receptive. I mean, people just eat it up.
Yeah.
And people want to be moved
yes.
in Russia. It's an escapism in a way. For them, out of the gray reality.
And you can feel the difference.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Yes. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The stage would be strewn over from with flowers. Uh-oh. You know, really, really. Not just a bouquet. No, it would be covered. And then my hotel room, in fact, last time I went with my daughter, and we would be in the hotel room for a day or two, that's it. And we would have to leave all those flowers. It was awful. I mean, here I'm lucky to get a bouquet.
Okay, so you traveled here and there, and did your family wind up in the United States?
No. No, my family wound up eventually in Europe. Mm-hmm. And I moved on to United States because at that time I finished my my BA in music and basically an equivalent to conservatory and MA in music. And so there was really not much else.
Where were you living?
Well, I was in Israel and then in Europe, Germany, in fact, from all places. But my father was actually offered a position there in the conservatory in Germany. So that was sort of what kind of stabilized my family,
right.
So I had this little European center
yes, right.
with my mom and dad, from which I would, by the time I got to be a concert pianist, you know, I would sort of stationed there.
So where did you get your...
But I ended up going to New England Conservatory, which offered me a wonderful scholarship, fantastic full scholarship to artist diploma program, which is sort of like a PhD for performers, because I wasn't interested in academics, you know, so there is such a thing as PhD actually in music, but that's not what I wanted. I wanted to perform, all I wanted to do, and teach, you know, too. So I was very, very happy. It's a very freelance program. In fact, I eventually finished it up without even a teacher, all you had to do, it's in Boston, is to play several concerts in Jordan Hall, which is the best recital hall in Boston, and play a couple of times with orchestra concerto, you know. So that was my that was my schooling by that time. So I was, basically, that was my excuse to come to America. And then I got kind of stuck in America. But it's a good stuck.
Yes. We're happy to have
right.
you.
Yeah, right, yeah, right. But then we moved to Cleveland, Ohio, which I actually loved. You know, people dump on Cleveland. Mm-hmm. I love Cleveland. For me, it was extremely wonderful. Mm-hmm. There are several orchestras there that I could play with to my heart content. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the best orchestra, I think one of the maybe three or four best orchestras, not just in the United States, but in the whole entire world, Cleveland Orchestra. I just love that orchestra. And I was very lucky to be able to play, you know, several concertos and record several concertos. So now I have actually three CDs mastered. Brahms Second Concerto, which is very interesting because people say, whoa, you can play that? Well, if you can play that, you can play anything. You know? So, Rachmaninoff Third and Brahms Second, that's sort of like the pinnacle. You know, Mount Everest. If you can climb Mount Everest, nothing, everything is just a small hill.
Right.
But I also have this last concerto, which is Beethoven Number 4, which I think the most profound concerto, one of the most profound concerti for piano and orchestra, and Chopin Concerto. Mm. So, and I have other seven solo CDs, which, so, you know, that was very good to me. Cleveland was very good for me. And the only reason I decided to actually move to Sarasota is because that was one of my stops. And by that time I had a little child to think of, and I said, oh, I don't have to actually worry about snowsuits. Oh, yes! And I can buy my tickets to travel from Sarasota to anywhere else, wherever I need to play, including Europe, just as well as I could from Cleveland. So let me take a sabbatical. Well, that was my famous last words, because that was many years ago. I never moved back. I thought I would, but I never did.
No. How long have you been here?
Oh, over a decade.
Ah!
Yeah. And I am, you know, one thing that I love about Sarasota, actually, that there is absolutely amazing amount of things, cultural going on. So that's the only place, actually, and I've been many places in Florida which never inspired me to move to until I stopped in Sarasota. I had a concert in, opera, what is it called?
The opera house.
Yes, mm-hmm. The opera house. That was one stop, and I had, you know, in the middle of February, come out of the airport, you know, and I saw the swaying palms and balmy breeze and smiling people.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, people actually smile in Sarasota.
I know.
Versus like Cincinnati. You know? Then I had a layover in Cincinnati and everybody was rushing with the briefcases and all gray and haggard and said, what's wrong with that picture? So that's how I ended up actually home-based in Sarasota. Because I actually love the, I love the warmth, and I love the fact that I can, if I want to stay around for a couple of months, I have plenty of places I can play concerts in, including my, by the way, usual, as long as we are talking, my general annual perennial concerts that I do always the first Sunday of the year. Uh-huh. Even when it was the 1st of January, I dared to do it. And finally, I thought nobody will show up. Well, it was the best turnout. I guess people were holidayed out, so they wanted something to do on the 1st of January. So there was great concert. I do that for Unitarian Universalist Church in Manatee County, which I don't belong to, but I love people there and they love me, so I do that for them. And then I do the third Sunday at Unitarian Universalist Church in Sarasota.
On
Fruitville
Road.
Right by Beneva and mm-hmm. Fruitville, yes. And I do that every year, so people can actually just put that on the calendar.
So let's just say it again. It's the first Sunday.
First Sunday of January. No matter what date it is, this 2015 is actually 4th mm-hmm. of January at 4 o'clock. Mm-hmm. Easy to remember. 4th of January at 4 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a Sunday, the 18th, also at 4. Always
great.
At 4.
Great.
My Sunday's at 4. You know, once I changed it to 5, and there's yet people were coming at 4. It was futile.
Yes.
And once I had to do it at 3:30 because they were kicking me out of the hall. Something was happening there at 5 or something. So I did at 3:30. People still showed up at 4. So there's no sense.
Okay, so I have one remaining question.
Yes.
And that is...
Only one?
Only one. Only one. And that is, and really we've been talking about it, so if you, there's something you want to add to this. Having given a life, and you have given an entire life to the art of the piano, really. Is there anything you would say about what that's like?
Hard.
Hard.
Hard. And actually lonely.
Yes.
Actually, you asked me before about whether I enjoyed it or something, or maybe I said it even without your asking. It's interesting because it's totally, you know, they say peak experience to be on stage. And on stage, I don't know even why on stage, but just feeling surrounded by people who are receiving, whether they are receivers or non-receivers or anywhere in between, that it's actually quite heady experience, you know, just to have people in your power. And you know, if I do this little rubato and make people hang on every note, and I feel that there's absolute silence, the pin drop, the proverbial pin drop, not being heard. And that is a very power kind of trip. But actually, my peak experiences is when I feel that that spirit flashes through me. And it's like nothing that I can describe. On the other hand, when I am at home and playing my wonderful 7.5 concert grand, I have those experiences too, because sometimes I even invoke the spirit because I am in pain sometimes. I am being tortured. I don't know where I am going. I feel blind. And in fact, I'm not even anymore fearful of admitting that. Because I all of a sudden found, or several times in my life found, that all artists have those experiences. Even the greatest that I've ever met. And we had these conversations. I had these conversations with great conductors and great performance, pianists or otherwise. And they all report that they sometimes feel like they are grappling in the mist. That's how I describe it.
Yes.
You know, I'm in a mist. I don't know where I'm going. I don't exactly know what I want. I don't know what the composer wanted. And I have to become humble and feel inadequate and feel pained because I feel inadequate.
Yes.
And then the revelations start popping up into my soul, into my head, I don't know where, to my spirit. You know, all of a sudden images, and then I jot them down because, of course, I think I will never forget it, and of course I will forget it. In fact, I find my music of 20 years ago with the notes, and I said, oh, wow, I've discovered it then?
Mm-hmm.
And now I all of a sudden have the same experience or similar experience. And 20 years ago, let's say some things that I play for decades, since the conservatory, you know, are in my repertoire, like Chopin's sonata, or ballads, or Brahms concerto, you know, things like that. They stay in your repertoire for decades. And people ask me, how do you feel about that? I said, always different.
Wow.
And people who follow me, kind of, you know, I have this hardcore fans, they can go listen to the same program from one place to another, especially if I am here within a 150-mile radius. They would go, I have die-hard fans. I love them. You know, they go, and I said, aren't you getting tired of hearing the same program? Because I run around, you know, the area playing the same program. Then I changed it,
right.
You know. But I said, no. I said, how come, you know, aren't you already knowing this? I said, oh, yeah, I know every note already. I have it in my sleep. One of my friends said, my gosh, I woke up with that Beethoven in my head. You really did that number on me, you know. Now it's in my head. I can't get rid of it. I said, well, aren't you bored? I said, no, because it's always new, because that's what I believe spirit and the soulfulness do, because every time I play it, it comes through anew. Yes, of course I have my basic, you know, my basic story. I know what I am talking about. I know what I try to express. I know where I want people to fly up with me and where I want them to melt in bliss. If I can do that, that's wonderful. But every time I have to put my soul into it, or else it doesn't happen.
That is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much, Eleonora.
Thank you. I may have gotten